The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
40 years ago today, July 13th, 1985, rock and pop history was made when an estimated global audience of 1.9 billion watched on TV and a combined total of 160,000 fans attended the gigs in London and Philadelphia, watched Live Aid. The show was originally conceived by Bob Geldof following the huge success of the single Do They Know It Christmas, and It's Christmas, and with the aim of raising more money for those impacted by the ongoing famine in Ethiopia. Joining me now to reflect on it all is Harvey Goldsmith, Live Aid promoter and co-producer, and journalist Barbara Power, who was at the gigs in Wembley themselves. Harvey, obviously we know that, you know, Bob Geldof, he was hugely involved, but bring us into the backstory. How did it all come about?
Well, I knew Bob and I'd worked with the Boomtown Rats, so that was a start point. All of us were shocked when we saw the pictures of Michael Burke's piece that went on the 6 o'clock TV news on the BBC, which was unprecedented, of children dying and starvation. And it hit everybody in the country, and it hit Bob particularly, and he wanted to do something about it. And so he got together with Midge, and the Do You Know It's Christmas record was created. And that went out, became number one. And that really was the start of it. Bob was persuaded reluctantly to go to Africa to see for himself, because he wanted to keep the momentum going. And the press said, we'll only do that if we can get pictures of you there. And so he went. When he got there, he saw that the devastation was so much bigger than he'd ever imagined, and realised that even though the amount of money they'd raised on the record, which was something like over £7 million, which is unheard of, was a spit in the ocean. So he came back from Africa with the idea that he wanted to do a concert. I was incredibly busy that year. I was looking after Roger Waters and helping him with his solo career, and we were launching a new album at Radio City in New York. And so that was my concentration. And then I got a phone call from Wham's manager, Simon Napier-Bell, and the conversation went, Wham are going to play two concerts in Hong Kong. And I said, great. And he said, and then I've arranged for them to go to play in China, but I can't go to China, so you'll have to take them. And he put the phone down, and I didn't even know where he was. I didn't get hold of it. So I'm scratching my head thinking, how the hell do I get from New York to Hong Kong and then to China? And then I was working with Bruce Springsteen, who was going to play Wembley Stadium. So I had a pretty busy time going on. And Bob started to call me and said, look, I want to do this concert. And I said, look, I just had a call from Wham's manager, and he wants me to take the band to China, which I've got to do. I have no idea what's going to happen. I don't even know if I'm going to come home, let alone get there. So you'll have to wait till I get back. And that's why the whole Live Aid event was done in such a short space of time, because I really didn't know what was going to happen in China, and nor did I know if I get back in time. So that really was the setting for why it was done in such a short space of time.
And so then, obviously, really tight schedule. How did you go about getting all of the massive names on board? And what was the reception like at the time? Were they clued in that this was going to be something big and they wanted to be part of it? Or did it take a bit of cajoling?
They didn't know anything about it until we got to the point where we started to put a structure together. I pulled in the best production people on the planet to help me put this together, because without them, there's no way I could do it. We were starting to contact artists and kind of getting okays or whatever. And then we had to announce the concert. So we had this press conference at Wembley Stadium in the ballroom. And I think it was the largest gathering of press I'd ever seen in my life. And at which point, Bob stood up and rattled off a list of names, which was the top 20 acts in the world, none of whom had agreed to play. That's how it started.
Fake it till you make it.
So I went into, you know, into the press conference with two givens, Ultravox, which was Midge's band, and the Boomtown Rats. That was it.
And how did they, presumably some of them heard their name being announced and went, sorry, what? I'm doing what? But actually then came on board.
Yes. So obviously everyone was starting to question it, whatever. Everybody realised what's going on. And of course, when we started, we then had to do all the follow-ups. And, you know, it was a bit like, thanks for announcing us, very kind of you. What the hell expletive do you think you're doing? And then when we explained it to them or whatever, slowly but surely, they came on board. I think what happened was all the artists in, which is what they normally do with these multi-events, multi-group events, they all started to phone each other and say, are you doing it? Are you doing it? Nobody wanted to say no. So they all agreed to do it, which was very clever on Bob's behalf, I have to admit.
No, nothing like a bit of peer pressure to get them all in. But is it true? Because obviously one of the most iconic performances is Queen, like no doubt. But is it true that Bob didn't want them initially?
No, nobody wanted them except me. I'd worked with Queen. I knew what they could do. And as I was starting to program the show, how the order of the day worked, when, which was a combination of the production capability, i.e. how quickly can we turn the groups around and what they were going to perform, I realised that it was going to be a lull, like in all big events, late afternoon, all these one-day events, there's always a lull in the afternoon. So I thought the best pick-me-up that I could think of would be Queen, and that was the slot I chose for them. And Bob was 100% against it because he thought they were kind of a little bit over the hill, whatever. And finally, of course, when I contacted Queen, because I put my foot down with Bob, Queen said, well, we're really tired. We just got off a tour. And, you know, we don't know if we want to play. So it was a double-edged persuasion that we had to do. When they agreed to do it, of course, they thought they were going to headline. But of course, subsequently, and when they actually performed, not only did they deliver the best segment ever, but of course it's really what they're known for. It lifted them up 1,000 times bigger than they ever were before.
Yeah, it's absolutely iconic. And I presume there were quite a few other acts who also thought they were going to have to headline. What was it like trying to massage all the various egos?
Well, everybody that was on that show was a headliner. So I've done lots of these types of shows. And at some point, if you're I call myself a producer more than a promoter. If you're the producer, you've got to decide how it works and they're going to have to run with it. And so as we paced out the show, we paced out what we believe was the best spot for each of those acts. And so they were all headlining their own segment at their own time. And it was natural, I think, for Paul McCartney to end up the show. And the slots that were chosen seemed to work really well, just dropped into place.
Yeah. I can think of it being a producer's nightmare, not only from that point of view, but now you think two concerts happening, two different cities across the side of the world and both being, you know, simulcast. That's not a bother now. Very different in 1985, I imagine, trying to get all of that to fit together and work as a show and a spectacle going out to, what, nearly 2 billion people?
It was unprecedented. Never happened before. And Bob and I, it became a bit yin and yang. He'd throw the challenge out and I'd go, screw you, I'm going to do it. Well, that's kind of what happened because he woke up one morning and thought, just doing a show at Wembley Stadium's great, but it's not going to get global attention. So we've got to do two shows. And then, of course, he kind of just said to me, you know, go and get Shea Stadium, because that's the stadium he knew about because the Beatles had played there. And, of course, it wasn't available. And nor was the other big stadium in New York, Giant Stadium, nor was the stadium in Washington or Boston. And I knew that the show had to be on the East Coast because of the 5-hour time difference opposed to the West Coast, which is 8 hours, and that would never work. So we sat with the BBC, and just remember, no mobile phones, no computers, no technology. There were just landlines and something called a telex machine, which you typed into a tape and it would come out the other end as a very lowered sheet of paper. That was the only way of communicating. So, and we, when we sat with the BBC engineers, we had to work out where the satellites were, literally on a map. We're using a pair of calipers, which are a pair of pincers that you just slide along the map to try and figure out, you know, distance. And so that's how it was in 1985. And what the one thing I did know is that if this was going to work, everybody had to stick to split second timing, because we had no idea if the satellite would really be where it was meant to be at the time it was meant to be there, and nor did the engineers.
It's a remarkable bit of engineering for 1985 to get through there. There's some amazing backstage stories. You know, there's the one of Phil Collins going on stage in London, then getting the Concorde over to Philadelphia and performing at that like, you know, talk about a real rock star thing to do. Are there some that maybe haven't been out there before? What was your favorite backstage story with all those the massive celebrities behind the scenes?
It was quite, the atmosphere was incredible. On the morning of the show, the first thing, when I woke up in the morning, I looked out the window, the sun was shining, and I thought, fantastic, that's a great start. And then when I got to the venue at about 7:30 in the morning, I got hold of one of the crew and I said, go out and buy me 40 clocks. And he went out and bought 40 clocks, and I had one of his assistants type out a message that says, I don't care what time you go on, but I do care what time you come off, stick to time. And I plastered these clocks and the messages everywhere, including me walking around with a clock around my neck, because it was so important that everybody had to at least come off at the right time. We designed in the office this circular turntable stage, because that way we could have one band playing, one coming off and one being set up, and that also cut down the changeover time. So all that was laid out, and, you know, and it was, again, a first, but at least we tested it out and it seemed to work okay. And those were the kind of main areas. And then, of course, Bob had persuaded the Prince and Princess of Wales to turn up. And when they did, the whole atmosphere got really exciting and changed a bit. And they came and stayed and watched the first part of the show. So that was exciting. But, of course, my biggest memory, of course, was after all the persuasion and the agreement for Paul McCartney to come, in the rush to get him on stage, one of the road crew unfortunately tripped over a cable, and so he could hear his monitors, but the audience couldn't hear anything. And so that became the notorious moment. And of course, when Bono went out during his slot, I went out into the audience to what appeared to be to rescue a girl he thought was being crushed at the front, and brought her over and spent time in the audience being shoved around, you know. And that delayed it a bit, and the band were furious. So it was another moment. And of course, the real moments of the whole show, the most poignant moments of the show, was David Bowie. David Bowie and Bob came up to my office for us to talk about what David wanted to do at the show. And I had a big screen television in my office, and we had a load of videos that we were looking at for what is called interstitial programming, i.e. what goes on in between the acts while we were changing over little snippets. And Bob brought some with him, and we were just putting them on while we were talking and kind of looking at them, taking them out, putting them on. And suddenly this video, which was produced by Canadian Broadcasting, to the music of the Cars Drive, that showed those emotive pictures of children dying and starving and the famine and so on, that David looked, so we all welled up just looking at these pictures, and David said, I'm going to drop a number, you've got to put that in my section. And Bob said, well, I don't think the broadcasters were allowed to do it. He said, I don't care, that's going in my section. And when he dropped the number to put that video on and he announced it, that was the turning point for the fundraising, and actually rammed home the whole reason why we were doing the concert.
Mm.
And that was the single most important turning point of the whole show.
And finally, Harvey, you were involved in Live 8 as well in 2005. Do you think it's something that could happen in the 21st century that we live in now with social media, with everything else? Or was it just one of those moments that will be forever belong to 1985 and it suited that era perfectly?
It did suit that era perfectly. 2005, Live 8, we, as the trustees, and we still exist today as trustees, and we're still giving out money every year, came as a result of Arsis, of Madonna and Elton John and Bono calling us, saying, you've got to do something. We didn't actually want to do a concert, but they got on our case and said, you've got to do something, because the G8 conference of the leaders of the world was happening in Scotland, and the whole debate at the time was putting pressure on them to put Africa on the agenda, which they'd never really discussed before. And so that came about as a result of Arsis. So going forward today, could you do it again? Yes, of course you could do it again. But it's got to come, I think, more from the Arsis community than from producers trying to do something.
Harvey Goldsmith, producer, co-producer of Live Aid and veteran promoter as well. Listen, thanks so much for joining us on the show on News Talk today. Really appreciate your time and good to share those memories.
Thank you.
Now, of course, one of the most famous moments, the famous clips, here it is. Of course, Queen, Barbara Power, you were there. I mean, what was it like?
It was incredible. And that call and response was just hair standing up on the back of your neck moment. Hey. I was there. I was so lucky to be asked by the Evening Herald to cover the event. I had been staffed the year before. Brought two competition winners out, two brothers from Artane, Donal and Vincent, and Shields, and arrived around this time. 40 years ago, we were marching up to the front door of Wembley. And it was the old Wembley, you know, the white towers, not the one with the wraparound architecture now. Oh, listen, it was so memorable. I mean, Radio Gaga was, for me, a highlight. I mean, Queen did. They were the act of the day, undoubtedly. But the sense of atmosphere, I mean, it was just electric.
Mm.
And I have to say, the U2 boys, you know, Bono was very impressive. I mean, there was controversy that he overran, you know, with his song Bad and then couldn't perform Pride, which the band weren't very happy about. But it was a gamble that paid off because it really picked up, resonated with the crowd and with the TV camera and cameras. And I know afterwards the band members were kind of like, if they were annoyed with him, I think they were a little surprised at the reaction to it. And his job as lead singer was saved. I mean, he's spoken about how he hates the mullet he was wearing, but leave the mullet out. The voice was amazing. But going back to the Queen performance, immediately after that, a video was shown, and it was Mick Jagger and David Bowie doing a video of Martha and the Vandellas dancing in the street. Now, it was brilliant on the day because they really camped it up. They did the video 2 weeks beforehand because the original plan that they would sing, you know, one in Wembley, one in Philadelphia, that couldn't work out. So they made this video. And it was great fun to watch. And I would say to listeners, if you know, go back on your phones and have a look at it today. But it's been panned since as one of the worst music videos ever. But you have to remember, with 2 weeks to go, they were trying to generate the right spirit. And, you know, there were lots of, you know, fun moments, lots of poignant moments. I thought, you know, Bob Geldof was and the Boomtown Rats, they were the third act up. And he sang I Don't Like Mondays. And then he paused. It was a very dramatic pause when he came to the line. You know, he
just back into your mic there a little bit.
Oh,
there.
Sorry.
You're all right. When the kind of the oh die, that line, wasn't it?
And the lesson today is how to die.
Yeah.
And that was written, you know, about a schoolroom shooter in San Diego. That's what it meant in that song. But on the day, it meant something else.
Yeah.
So for 20 seconds, fist in the air, crowd just responded. They knew what he was talking about. You know, we were there for a purpose. We were there to raise funds. Mm. And it was very moving. I mean, I laugh when I look back at some of the behind-the-scenes stories. And in fact, I was invited to speak at the National Library the other day because they're launching their online access to the Live Aid photographs. But the speaker there, Andrew Wilde, he wrote a book last year about Live Aid, The Greatest Show on Earth. And for anyone who is into trivia, do look it up. It's a brilliant book from Sonic Bond. And all the trivia, all the behind-the-scenes. I mean, I didn't know... Elton John set up fake grass and a barbecue at the back, and he was feeding them all his friends. And Freddie Mercury came up to him and started slagging him about his hat. And David Bowie had to go off and try and appease the father of the bride nearby on a cricket pitch because the helicopter was landing there.
Oh,
and he was worried about the noise. So he went down and posed with the bride and groom. Everything's sorted.
Everything's well. I mean, if Bowie's going to come and pose with you, that'll fix a lot. Barbara Perry, you were there 40 years ago. Like you say, there is that exhibit online and the book as well by Andrew Wilde, Live Aid. Lots of facts in that.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.